Thanks for joining us on Back on Air, the podcast for operators who have compliance on their mind and road transport at the heart of their business. This podcast is a recording of our live fortnightly webinar held every other Friday. So if you like what you hear and fancy joining the live event where you can ask questions and vote on our interactive polls, just register through the link in the show notes. The content of this podcast is correct at the time of broadcasting, but it isn't meant to be specific legal advice. If, however, you need advice, we recommend that you take proper legal advice for your individual situation. Finally, please do leave us a review and, of course, details of any areas you would like us to cover in future episodes. We do read them and it helps others find our podcast. Enjoy!
Good afternoon, everybody. Yes, Chloe's hosting the webinar for us today, but I'm joined by both Scott Bell and Stephanie Walker-Dine. Scott's going to provide us with the regulatory insight to the scenarios that we've got planned for you, and Stephanie's going to provide the employment insight. There's three scenarios that we're going to work through today. To do with, if we move on, Chloe.
Yeah, sorry.
Chloe's pressed the button, but now we're waiting for the slide to spring into life. So yeah, we've got a number of scenarios that we're going to run through with you today. Hopefully spend quite a bit of time looking at the implications and use of external transport managers, but also transport managers generally, and looking at what you should be doing if you are one of those transport managers, whether internal or external, but also looking at it from the operator's perspective. So hopefully spend quite a bit of time on that. Also, we're going to look at the fact that there's an end brought to making applications for operators' licences through the paper system. It's all going to be online only going forward. So we'll look at perhaps some of the implications in relation to that, but I suspect that most of you are already embracing that system. It's been in for a good while now. And then looking at corporate manslaughter and health and safety cases generally, there's been a recent well-publicised case involving a transport company. We'll have a look at that and what it means for transport companies, but also directors, officers of the company, and what perhaps if you're a transport manager, what your position is in relation to health and safety matters, and potentially finding yourself in the dock as far as offences as serious as corporate manslaughter are concerned. So we'll look at that. And also, as you've no doubt spotted in the news, that COVID is on the rise. Everyone seems to know somebody with COVID at the moment. So we'll look at what that means, particularly from an employment angle, in terms of dealing with employees who've got COVID, or perhaps they've been into contact with a family member, for example, that's got COVID, and where you stand now, because obviously there was a lot of guidance about this at the time during the pandemic, which changed over time. But where do we stand now? So that's the areas that we're looking to cover today. But two news items that aren't in there. One is an internal Backhouse Jones news item that yesterday Laura Smith, who many of you who are stalwarts of this webinar will remember and know well, she's just given birth yesterday to her second child, a son called Louis. She's well, and Stephen, my half, her other half, is also a director. So congratulations to both of those. So that's a good news story for us internally, and thought we'd share that with you, the listeners, as some of you will know Laura and Stephen well. Something completely unrelated, Ukrainian drivers. There's been some clarification in relation to the use of Ukrainian drivers by HGV drivers, by operators. And whether their HGV entitlement, the Ukrainian HGV entitlement, can be used in this country. It's a complicated point, but basically the position is that if they have a Ukrainian driver license, they can come into this country, but only to drive small vehicles, cars. The HGV entitlement isn't transferable to this country. So if you have any Ukrainian drivers, check their license for this. They would have to sit the HGV test in this country their car driving license is only valid for 12 months, and then they may have to make an application to the DVSA by the end of the 12 months to allow that to be transferred over. And the reasons for that is that Ukraine is not part of the EU, so there's a special dispensation that's been made, but it only goes as far as the car driving entitlements. They don't fall into that trap as far as any HGV or even PSV drivers might be concerned. Right, so I think that was a couple of news slots, two completely unrelated. So our first scenario is in relation to transport managers. So we've got here a scenario whereby we've got a transport manager who works in the business part-time. He's only dedicating 10 hours, or she is only dedicating 10 hours a week to that role, but the operator runs 30 vehicles. Thinking about getting an external transport manager in to assist, so to be running, by the sounds of things, running the two side by side, and how do we make this work, and is it something to notify to the OTC? So first of all, I want to just raise with Scott that we've got here a 30 vehicle operator, Scott, 10 hours that appears to be done by the transport manager dedicated to that role. First of all, is that enough?
It depends who you're asking, really, Mark. Good afternoon, everyone. It's great to see you all again. They've let me loose on the webinar finally after previous appearances went down a storm, I believe. But anyway, so going back to the question in hand, is it enough? We moved from a system some years ago where transport management and sort of the time dedicated to the role or how many hours you expected to put in was very much the proof's in the pudding. If you're running a compliant operation and things were running smoothly, the traffic commissions weren't particularly interested in how many hours on what days you were doing your transport manager role. We had a bit of a sea change a few years ago, especially when the test changed from effective in continuous control to effective in continuous management, where the traffic commissioners asked transport managers to specify the number of hours that they were seeking to work on that license. In general terms, the senior traffic commissioners set out the starting points of suggested hours that transport managers should be performing for a function. The starting point for 30 vehicles is around about 20 hours a week, from recollection. And therefore, if the transport manager in this scenario is only undertaking around about 10 hours per week, the traffic commission might be entitled to ask and look at that scenario and that situation, in particular if there's a problem. If the DVSA come in to do an investigation, it raises issues, and as part of that, it raises that the transport manager is only really performing 10 hours per week. The traffic commissioner can quite easily say to the transport manager and the operator, well, why are you only doing 10 hours a week? If you're dedicating more time, you may not have these issues. So when you're looking at the transport management role, firstly, it's really important to look at what you've declared on the TM1 form originally. I dare say that if it was declared on the TM1 form that you're only doing 10 hours per week, it probably raised some questions at the time you nominated yourself as transport manager. But if that is significantly changed from the point you made your nomination to this point because your job role's changed or circumstances, you might have to consider whether you are meeting the test of having an effective and continuous management of that transport operation, which may lead on you onto you having to do something. The only other aspect I'd put that quite often people put down the number of hours because they think of it as, well, that's the time I spend looking at the maintenance records or the driver's hours records. In reality, you're the transport manager all the time you're at the business. You know, you don't switch off from being a transport manager. And sometimes transport management is much more than just looking at records. If you're involved in business decisions, i.e. taking on new contracts or tendering for new work, part of that process is thinking about from a transport management and compliance aspect, okay, what resource do we need to put in? Do we need to recruit additional drivers for the driver's hours, for the working time? What maintenance do we need to put in place for those vehicles? And that is all part of the transport manager function. So that's a very long answer for 10 hours per week, Mark. But it gives you a flavour, and sometimes you've got to be very careful in what you say to the DVSA in terms of the hours you say. And if you are only doing 10 hours per week for a 30 vehicle operation and not really much more, I dare say that you're going to be on the back foot of explaining yourself if you ever have a problem.
And I think in this scenario, perhaps the operator has highlighted there that we've got a transport manager a little bit part-time, so it sounds like he's employed, doing 10 hours, we run 30, so we're thinking about getting some assistance in. That we would agree with that, to get another person on the licence. Steph, if we just turn to you, though, this is talking about internal and external transport managers. Just so that everyone's clear, what is the difference there between internal and external?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Sorry, I just want to firstly apologise if you can hear any planes whizzing around in the background. I do actually live somewhere near Southport, and it's the air show this weekend, so I think they must be doing practice runs, so hopefully that won't interfere. But sorry, going back to the question. So the difference is, if you've got an external transport manager, generally you're engaging them on a consultancy type basis rather than having a contract of employment with them. And obviously when you've got an internal transport manager, that will entail them having a contract of employment. So it just means that the way in which they're dealt with can be slightly different. Obviously your internal is dealt with as an employee, and therefore, you know, they'll be subject to things like your internal disciplinary procedures, your internal grievance procedures, whereas an external transport manager, you know, the terms will kind of be determined by whatever's in your consultancy agreement with them.
Just on that point, Steph, if you've got an internal transport manager and this one's part-time but it's still being internally paid as part of the PAYE payroll, that person should have an employment contract just like any other employee. But what you're saying is an external doesn't have an employment contract, but nevertheless there should be a specific contract in place setting out their roles and obligations, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously with your internal employees, you know, you've got to bear in mind that it is a day one right to have Section 1 statement setting out all of the terms, but it's just as important to have something in place for an external transport manager setting out all of the important terms, because obviously, you know, you want to be sure that you're covering yourselves for, you know, what duties and obligations they've got, to make sure that they're, you know, they're compliant, make sure that there's a clear position on, you know, the number of devoted hours that you expect them to carry out the obligations for. You know, things like fees and payment terms, and also actually things like confidentiality and data protection, because you'll often find that those who are external transport managers, they might well be doing the same work but for different operators. So, you know, it's absolutely important that you've got all of the terms in a contract, because, you know, it's often only when a dispute arises that you then look in to see, well, actually, how do I deal with this situation? And as I said before, if they're not an employee or a worker, then, you know, you're not going to be able to rely on your internal disciplinary procedures with them, because, you know, they're not employees and they are treated slightly differently.
Come back to that in a moment, Stephanie, but Scott, something to pick up on there that Stephanie said, that an external transport manager can act for other operators as well, and Stephanie was rightly saying that, you know, confidentiality is something you want to look at in your contract there. But what about the way that transport manager provides their services? Are there issues with, as far as the traffic commissioner are concerned, with how you provide your services as an external transport manager?
Yeah, so in general terms, an external transport manager must be an actual person, must be an individual, and you must contract with that individual. You can't contract through a limited company, consultancy company, to provide those services. So the agreement between the operator and the transport manager must be with an individual transport manager. And usually they want to see payment being made to that individual transport manager. The other part of this is, and it's quite common actually, it's more common than you think, is the concept of a volunteer transport manager. And that's whether they are classed as an employee or external. You must be paid for the role. So the transport manager's on the call, you'll be quite happy to hear that you must be paid performing the function. And we've had cases down the years where traffic commissioners have looked at the payment being made to external transport managers and working it out that he was paid, the transport manager was being paid less than his dog walker. I don't know if he actually had a dog walker, because I've paid a dog walker in the past and they're quite expensive actually. But when they're sort of working out the hours, you're saying that you're going to work as against the payment. If it's incredibly low, below national minimum wage, for example, which some of these were, it would call into question whether there's a genuine link actually there.
I've actually got a question regarding a volunteer transport manager, so I'm going to butt in.
Right, yeah.
I work 37 hours a week as a driving examiner, and then a volunteer transport manager, I won't say the company, with two licences. I do 5 hours on a Wednesday after my main job and Saturdays online. Do you think that's acceptable?
So first and foremost, goes back to what I just said, you can't be a volunteer, you must be paid for the function. To demonstrate the genuine link. If you're providing a contract for services, you must have consideration. That is what a contract means, offer acceptance.
It would be payment, basically.
It's payment. So you have to be paid for the role you're performing. As to the hours that you're actually performing, it depends on the operational need. It goes back to what I originally said. It is incumbent upon you as the transport manager to be an effective and continuous management and do the hours that you need to do. Make sure in all the compliance objectives are being met. And I would say the proof is in the pudding.
I think the other thing I would add to that, and it comes on to what we're going to discuss later on in the scenarios, particularly in relation to health and safety matters, that a transport manager is an officer of the company or officer of the business, a manager. So deemed to be at a relatively high level within the organisation, and that you take on personal responsibilities yourself from health and safety perspective. But what about, I suppose, the role, Scott, generally as a transport manager in terms of what that entails with the traffic commissioner, the seriousness of that role? By being a volunteer, you are putting yourself in harm's way, for want of a better term, because if things aren't right within the business and there's a DVSA investigation, then you are going to get called before the traffic commissioner, and the people that end up potentially having action taken against them are the operator, the directors, and the transport manager. So if you're doing this role as a favour, as a volunteer, one, we wouldn't recommend that anyway for the reasons that Scott has said, but two, you really are taking on a serious role that shouldn't just be done as a favour.
Yeah.
No, I've got absolutely loads of questions.
Right, good. We'll come back to the scenario in a minute.
So this is just a comment, really. There's too much competition in London. Some people are advertising on Gumtree for £350 to be an external transport manager.
Yeah.
Why is there a limit for the number of vehicles an external transport manager can manage, whilst there is no limit for an internal transport manager?
Really, really simple. That's what the law says. So the European legislation sets down a limit for external transport managers, which is 4 operators with a cumulative total between the 4 operators of up to 50 vehicles. Mm-hmm. There has been a change in the legislation for internal as well. We've always worked on the rule of thumb of 1 transport manager for 50 vehicles. The European legislation now says that the national authorities, traffic commissioners, can set a limit, and whilst there's nothing in the guidance, we fully expect it will be around about 50 vehicles.
I am the named transport manager on a licence for 20. I would spend 90% of my time driving and only 10% in the office. Do you think this is adequate?
No.
Probably not. Okay. Again, it's a lot of external and internal transport managers these days work remotely. Most compliance systems now are remote. Your TACOs, your PMI reports are coming through on the computers. You can get access to tracking. You can get remote downloaders for vehicles and driver units. But the transport manager is meant to be visible as well. And part of the expectation of the traffic commissioner is that the transport manager is known to the drivers, is available on site, gets to see face-to-face the drivers, and takes up issues with the drivers, and also sits down face-to-face with the director if it's not the same person. I dare say that if you're spending 95% of your time driving and 5% on transport manager for a 20 vehicle operation, there won't be enough time to do everything you should be doing. I'll put it that way.
And lastly, in your honest opinions, Do you honestly think 20 hours is adequate for a TM of 30 vehicles?
It depends what you've got in place. If it's a fully paper system, you're physically going through and checking defect reports are all paper-based, you've got no assistance whatsoever, you're doing it all yourself, who knows? I guess from our perspective, when we deal with public inquiries, and Mark would be the same, you get a flavour very quickly looking at records of where you sit, but that's because we know what we know, and sometimes people we deal with don't know what they don't know. So we can spot issues very, very quickly because we've seen the issues over and over again. For my part, 20 hours, I think you're probably looking at, what, 4 or 5 inspection reports a week, depending on trailers as well, downloading tachos, it's dealing with the drivers. I think you probably might need a bit of assistance.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think the traffic commissioner is more and more talking about taking a risk-based approach to various systems, particularly tyre management. Why am I talking about tyre management? Well, the questions about transport managers. But what they mean by a risk-based approach is that certain types of operation are much more risky than others. So if you're using vehicles off-road, building sites and so forth, they require you to have perhaps more stringent systems as far as your tyre management is concerned. Now, they haven't applied that approach in relation to the number of hours to transport management, to an operator. They haven't said if you're operating a trunking based operation, then the number of hours perhaps the transport manager needs to spend by the transport manager needs to be less than if you're doing something that's more risky, shall we say. Which is interesting because they are applying that thought to other types of process to do with compliance. I think the reality is that those numbers are a guide by and large, and that as long as the job is being properly done and you're somewhere near those numbers, then you should be okay. But I think a lot of transport managers, though, are doing their job, but perhaps to the standards that were required a good number of years ago. And regularly now we're seeing public inquiries where the transport managers haven't properly interrogated a maintenance document that's coming by. They just filed it. Haven't properly interrogated a brake test. They're just seeing it says pass on it rather than looking and understanding what's the detail of the brake test is. And things have moved on a lot in the last number of years, and they continue to do so. Brake testing is a big one, bridge strikes and so forth. We've talked about them a lot.
Driver's hours. I mean, the days of just signing off the infringement sheet to say you spoke to the driver are long gone. You're meant to be looking at patterns and trends and whether particular drivers are continuing having those issues. So it's not just the case of sign that report and file it away anymore.
Exactly. And one of the things that we've talked about on these webinars before, and also give specific training courses on, is the new requirements as far as driver's hours are concerned, but to make sure all duty is recorded on the tachograph, including any rest periods. So it's about keeping up to speed with these things, keeping yourself informed, reading the DVSA guides, and all of that stuff counts towards your role as a transport manager. Yeah. So if you're doing all of those things, I would suspect that you're actually going to get near the guidelines suggested by the OTC.
And I guess sort of following on from that, Mark, and one of the things that we quite often deal with is the visibility of the transport manager. So transport manager tell us they're performing the function, looking at the records, but we can't physically identify much by way of that. And in my view, the best external transport managers, and to a degree internal transport managers, are highly visible and are able to produce documents and records to show that they're basically on the ball. So, for example, the best external transport managers I see will send the operator a weekly email or a report on a weekly basis saying, this is what's happened last week. We've dealt with XYZ. You know, we've had to deal with XYZ driver on infringements. This driver needs speaking to. This is what's due for next week. I need this vehicle to go in for this service provider on this date. we need to speak to this driver. Can you arrange for him to call me on a Thursday or whatever the case may be? Because I need to speak to him about the records, or bring the driver into the office when I'm in the office on the Friday. And this is what we need to look at for the future. And if a transport manager is able to show that type of record keeping through, I mean, some people keep a diary, but ideally a record that goes to the operator as well on email is a really simple way. The DVSA come in and say there's what XYZ issue or whatever the case may be. At least you've got some tangible evidence to say that you're not only being reactive, you're being proactive, you're telling people what's going on, you're providing a plan for the future, you're addressing future needs. And for me, that is the best way of demonstrating that, not concentrating so much on the hours, but concentrating on the output and what needs to happen. So you're not reactive, you're more proactive with things.
And presumably, Scott, for an internal transport manager as well, should be reporting from the transport management team up to the board, so the board know what's going on.
Exactly. So one of the things that we've put in place for years is almost, it's a mixture of a KPI assessment plus an internal management report. So myself and Mark, we've got sort of compliance agendas, which forms basically a meeting that's designed to be between a transport manager and a director, which goes through all of the compliance aspects that may have happened in the previous couple of weeks or month since the last meeting, where we're at now, what we are, you know, MOT failures, we had any prohibitions, we got any particular problems with any drivers on infringements, and what we're looking to do for the future. Again, an internal transport manager who can produce such a document to say, look, we're sitting down as a team and meeting and discussing at the points, it's very, very powerful to the traffic commissioner. You know, if there's ever a problem, and more on DVSA investigations, we're getting a comment from the DVSA officer to say, I can see infringement reports are being signed, but I can't see any evidence that the transport manager's involved in that process. Or I can see all the inspection reports are coming through. They've got these obvious issues, but I can't see that the transport manager's really touched them at all. So having that tangible evidence would help massively.
What about, we see this quite often, where a transport manager has signed off a PMI maintenance record. And when I say signed off, I'm talking about
quality access check or something.
Well, there's two ways, aren't there, here? So there's a quality check, which you talk about, but there's also signing off the thing to say that the vehicle's roadworthy. Yeah, but we see it a lot. Yeah. Or you see it from time to time. What's the issue there?
Okay, so the declaration of roadworthiness, in our opinion, the only person that should be signing that off is the person that's assured themselves that that vehicle is being inspected, the repairs have been done, it's now roadworthy. So unless you physically look around that vehicle yourself and check the inspection and the repairs, I would not be signing that document, because if that vehicle goes down the road and has an accident and it's got your signature on as the last person to say that that vehicle is roadworthy and there's an obvious braking defect or something along those lines, the first door they'll be knocking on is yours. So I definitely do not be signing the declaration of roadworthiness unless you physically check that vehicle yourself. On quality checks, if you've signed a quality check to form or put a stamp on or put your signature on to say that it's fine
on the actual
PMI, that's no problem with that. I'd recommend it's visible to say that you've checked the sheet. The problem comes sometimes is then the knowledge that when I look at that sheet or a traffic commissioner looks at the sheet, they might pick up some issues that you don't pick up because you don't have the knowledge sometimes to pick up that. So that's all about keeping yourself up to date, understanding what the traffic commissioners and DVSA are looking for, which is why everybody encourages regular CPDs, why you tune in for this webinar as well. So there's no issue with you putting a quality check stamp or your signature to say you've checked the form. Again, some of the best transport managers I see will put a sheet on the top of the inspection, say it's been received on this date, been checked by me, we've had a valid brake test, everything's back, all defects been signed off. So it just shows it's a bit of an audit form that you've had. Yeah. Again, they like that sort of information being there.
And just to bring you back in, Stephanie, you said before about how an external transport manager isn't an employee of the business, so they would expect them to have a proper contract. What happens then if, for example, you've got this scenario here where you've got an internal transport manager, someone who's employed by the business, and an external working side by side. And for some reason, that team dropped the ball and we find that the company find through an audit or whatever process it may be, hopefully not because of the sat in front of the traffic commissioner at a public inquiry, but that could be the case. What can they do in relation to those two different transport managers used in different circumstances? And what might the different outcomes be?
Yeah, so I think that your first step is always going to be carrying out an internal investigation to obviously identify what the failures are, you know, what they've been caused by, because you might find that it's, you know, predominantly attributable to one or the other, but you might find that actually both are just as culpable as the other. But obviously with the external transport manager, because they're not employees, you know, you're not going to be able to follow your usual disciplinary process with them if you find that there has been wrongdoing. But that's where your contracts come into play, because hopefully within those contracts you should have the terms setting out, you know, what happens if there's a dispute, what happens if there's been a breach of their obligations. And often you find that, you know, if it is just a mere dispute, there'll be terms that kind of set out how that's to be dealt with. But if there is fundamentally a breach of, you know, one of their obligations under that contract, a lot of the time the termination provisions allow the company to terminate the contract on the basis that there's been a breach. Obviously, you'll have to take a view as to how serious the breach is. You know, it's quite a drastic measure just to terminate the contract, but, you know, it may well be warranted. It may not be. You may be willing to overlook it, having done the investigation. But, you know, I'm not sure what the position would be from, you know, a regulatory perspective on that point. But I'm sure Mark or Scott will jump in if they've got any particular views.
Yeah. Well, just thinking, Stephanie, I suppose it's the case then that if you've got an external transport manager that you think has failed in some regard and an internal one that's also failed to the same level, presumably the internal one could be subject to a disciplinary procedure and receive maybe a warning or a final written warning, but the external one doesn't get a warning or a final written warning because they're not an employee. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, yeah, the internal, you'd look to carry out your usual disciplinary procedures. And obviously, your investigation is going to form a fundamental part of how you decide to deal with both of them. Because, as I said, if you find that perhaps the internal transport manager is perhaps, you know, there's a bit more culpability on their part, then you might well find that, you know, you go down the misconduct, gross misconduct route with them. And like you say, they might end up with a written warning or a final written warning or even a dismissal, depending on the severity of what's been done. And again, you'd have to take the view as to the seriousness with the external to decide what you wanted to do, because, there's, you know, there's kind of a middle ground with an internal, because, you know, you can issue the final written warning, which is obviously a serious sanction. But, you know, it's not so serious in that you're terminating the contracts, whereas with the external, you're either continuing with the engagement or you're looking to terminate, basically. So there's no in between, really, is there?
But you can still issue a warning to the external, and but you'd want that as part of the contract with the external about sort of improvements. So like any consultant that you'd engage, so if you're like a buildancy consultant or any way you engage a consultant, usually there'd be elements in the contract about sort of if there's a problem, how that's resolved, how, you know, are there any penalty clauses, maybe not going that far, but it might be that you say, well, if it's not rectified within a certain period, it entitles us to terminate the contract. So you can build some of that information in, but that, I mean, I've never seen that in an external transport manager contract, but we've seen it in other consultancy contracts you might deal with in other parts of life.
But I suppose if you're an operator and you've identified a problem with the external transport manager, but you've decided that it's not sufficient to part ways to terminate the agreement, I suppose it'd be prudent, though, to keep a record of what the issue was, because that can then be produced to the traffic.
Definitely notify it down, send a copy of it to the transport manager, expecting such as, you know, what the issue is and what the improvement plan is, and keep a record of that. Yeah, I mean, just we're sort of dealing with internal and external. And the scenario talks about having both engaged, which is absolutely fine. There's no problem with that whatsoever. In legal terms, as soon as you're a transport manager on the license, whether you're internal, external, there's 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 transport managers on a license. You're jointly and collectively responsible for that license. So if you're a large operator and you've got a operator license in the Northwest with 15 different depots and 20 different transport managers, and there's a particular issue at one particular depot, unfortunately, from a licensing and legal perspective, you're all in it together. What happens in practice and what you'd expect from those types of operations, same applies for internal, external, working in a smaller operational, is some sort of division responsibilities that's clearly set out. So you'd expect this person to be dealing with this, you know, maintenance, this person to deal with driver's hours and operational issues. What the Traffic Commission then expects is that those two transport managers will then discuss what their particular fiefdoms, and a prudent transport manager may from time to time check on the other transport manager and sort of self audit from bits and pieces. So if you're going down that route, you really need to clearly define some responsibilities.
I've just got one more question before we move on, if that's all right.
Of course. All right. I feel like Boris Johnson sticking around when I'm not wanted.
I am a transport manager with a firm operating 2 HGVs but 65 under 3.5 ton vehicles. How much should the operation of the non-O-licensed vehicles affect my standing as a CPC holder?
Well, it's interesting because if there's problems, if the problems are identified with that non-HGV fleet, prohibitions, MOT failures, that sort of thing, they can still affect the operator's license. So your duty really as a transport manager in that scenario, to me, extends beyond just those two vehicles on the fleet. You've got a duty to make sure those other vehicles are operating in the appropriate way. Just one other thing. Stephanie, you talked about having an external contract. Stephanie, presumably you'd recommend that people review what that contract looks like, and then someone like yourself or one of the other employment team can advise if it needs updating, and we have that sort of contract available, don't we, if people need it, a proper external transport manager.
Absolutely. Because as I said, you know, the issues tend to crop up as and when there's a dispute over the contract. So, you know, don't wait until there's a problem before you review it. You know, it's always a good idea to review these things periodically anyway. And yeah, it's definitely something that we can help you with.
And Scott, is that something that the DVSA get interested in when they come and do their health checks, or the Traffic Commissioner of the Public Inquiry, do they get interested in these?
Yeah, the Traffic Commissioner usually asks for a contract for services from the transport manager. You also declare as part of the TM1 that you've got a contract, a written contract in place, so you must have it if you have an external transport manager. The only other thing I'll add before Chloe kicks me under the table to move on, if any of you want help with an agenda, a transport manager agenda, putting in place, again, give us a shout. We've got them to hand, and we can help you with that.
Good, right. Okay, that was quite a lengthy session on that one, but I think it deserved it. Scenario 2 is much more straightforward. So basically, this is all to do with the scrapping of a paper application. And this scenario is a variation of an existing license. Paper application was sent in 6 weeks ago, but you've not heard anything back yet. Basically, all the information doesn't appear to have been on the application either. What should I do? And is there any difference post 2nd of August? So deal with the last bit first. Yes, there is the scrapping the paper application, so that won't apply from then on. But if we look at this paper application that's been sent in, Scott, it's been 6 weeks, not heard anything. Is that normal?
It's not normal. Usually you'd expect at least a letter coming out saying that you the supporting information is required because you've not supplied everything at the time. If you're sending applications in on paper, they are taking longer because they have to scan them on the system, go through the post room, scan onto the system, then be dealt with by the relevant clerk. Plus, paper applications have more scope for error, whereas the online applications, you can't really go forward without ticking the right boxes or ticking the correct boxes. So you're shooting yourselves in the foot really using paper these days. One thing I would say, because I'm sort of conscious on the time and we do want to deal with this HSE one, is that central licensing works on the basis that people get it right first time round, and that makes your application go much smoother. What I would say as well is that the caseworkers work on a task list. So wherever you are on that task list, you are there, and they'll be working on hundreds of applications at the time. And sometimes ringing the caseworker every day for an update on your own particular application is not going to get you any further forward, because all you're doing is delaying them getting on with that task list. Usually dropping an email to them as well sometimes can be dealt with, but if you're supplying information to them as a request, my recommendation to you is not to email, not to post it, but to upload that information on the VOL system, because then it creates a new task for them to do. Whereas if you email it to them, it's outside of VOL, and it doesn't become a task until they put it into VOL themselves. So just be aware of those little nuances. We deal with hundreds of applications in this firm, and you sort of get a very innate understanding of how that process works. So if you're struggling, just give our team a call on them.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that if you put in an application that doesn't have everything with it on that first go, then as Scott says, it goes on the caseworker's list. When it comes to the top of the list, the caseworker reviews it, and then they will send out a letter saying, well, we need X, Y, and Z, and then you've gone to the bottom of the list again, and then you have to work your way back up to the top. And if you still haven't produced everything that was required by that stage and have to come back to you, you just keep going back to the bottom of the list, and your application takes forever. So getting it right in the first instance is absolutely critical to getting your application dealt with quickly. Okay, fine. Well, that was a bit quicker, I think, than the first scenario. This third scenario, though, is the one that is linked with a recently reported case. So basically, this is a scenario whereby it's a tanker operator, but it's not limited to tanker operators. So bear with us. We'll talk about it in much wider terms. Basically, there's no risk assessments, and this individual's concerned that the particular task is dangerous for employees as they have to get into the tankers, and it's been flagged with the boss, but the boss basically says that they're being a fusspot, or any other term you want to use. This individual's a transport manager, not a director. Could I be liable for something that happens, and what should I do? Okay, so this is linked to this recent case in Leicester Crown Court. You can look it up on the internet, but it was a vehicle operator that was involved in this, operating tankers with, I think it was basically food supplies or to go into the animal food chain, so for pigs, I think, for pig feed. So it was unpleasant stuff that was kept in the tankers. And what happened was that one employee went into the tanker to clean it out, physically went into the thing and was overcome by the fumes. A second one then follows him in to try and help him, and he unfortunately ends up in exactly the same position, and both individuals died. So double fatality. And there was a prosecution of the company, prosecution of the two directors, and also prosecution of the transport manager. So all of those individuals found themselves in the dock before a jury in the Crown Court. And the company was looking at corporate manslaughter, but the individuals themselves were looking at gross negligence manslaughter allegations against them, plus allegations of general health and safety breaches. So I think the really important thing to take out of this is that, yes, the company can find itself being prosecuted, but also you as individuals, as directors, transport managers, whether you're part-time, internal, external, it doesn't matter. Because
or any individual, to be honest, but they never do.
No, generally they look at the officers of the company. And now, most of the time, the health and safety executive cases are against the actual limited company or the operator, depending on if it's a sole trader or a partnership. But normally, it's against the entity themselves. But if they find evidence that basically the directors or the managers, including transport managers of the business, have consented or connived or attributed to the neglect, which is the test under Section 37 of Health and Safety at Work Act, and those individuals themselves find themselves before the court and can find themselves being prosecuted. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. So one director who was a lady with no previous convictions, she's 60 years old, ended up with either a 13 or a 15 year sentence. I can't remember just which one it is now, but a huge sentence. So the judge was clearly not impressed at all with the way this business and the directors exercised their responsibilities. Another director was in prison for 2 years, and the transport manager managed to get a suspended sentence, a one-year prison term suspended for 2 years. Now, that was quite fact-specific, as I understand it. I'm not going into the detail of why the transport manager ended up with a much lesser sentence, but there were very specific reasons for that in that particular business structure. But in other structures, I would say more like the usual structure of transport manager and directors, I think it's foreseeable that a transport manager could get a very similar term of imprisonment or sentence for health and safety and work offences as the directors. So be aware of that. Yeah. And I suppose then it's a case of, that's what could happen, but how do we deal with the scenario as it's presented here? So you've got a concern as a transport manager, but it doesn't have to be a transport manager. It can be any other employee can have a concern in relation to the way things are being done. So what should you do? Well, I suppose, Stephanie, from an employment perspective, where do you stand here as an employee, whether you're a transport manager or just a general employee within a business?
Yeah, so there is actually statutory protections in place for employees that basically report malpractices to their employers. And so, you know, well, it's also known as whistleblowing. You might have heard that term before. But essentially what he's doing here is reporting a serious health and safety concern. And, you know, it need only be a concern, because it doesn't have to be that there's been a failure or that something's happened. It could be that there is a concern that something is likely to happen. So, you know, in the absence of a risk assessment, some, you know, a potential health and safety issue is likely to occur by not rectifying that. And so I suppose if you're looking at the transport manager raising this, presumably the people above them are the directors. And in these circumstances, the directors obviously doesn't appear to be too concerned. But say, for example, if it was an employee who had raised it to the transport manager, and it was the employee that was supposed to be cleaning the tank, and they've made inquiries about what risk assessments are in place, you know, is it safe to do this? Then the transport manager or the directors or whoever said, you know, don't worry about that, you're being fussy. The employee could legitimately refuse to carry out that job. And I think then as an employee, you're in a bit of a difficult situation, because you're going to struggle to discipline somebody for refusing to carry out an instruction, because, you know, there's obviously serious health and safety concerns here behind the reason as to why they are refusing. If you were to continue with any kind of disciplinary processes off the back of that, then you're at serious risk of whistleblowing claims, because you're essentially subjecting that employee to a detriment because they've raised this protected disclosure. And I suppose that the same could apply if it was the transport manager and say, you know, the boss off the back of this then decided, well, actually, I don't like the fact that he's raised this as a problem. He's being fussy, he's too much hassle, we're going to get rid of him, or, you know, I'm not promoting him to a director as well because of this, then, you know, again, those whistleblower protections would cover the transport manager for either suffering a detriment or a dismissal. And I think, you know, it's important, because if they are to bring claims in employment tribunals for either a detriment or a dismissal, the potential awards are uncapped. So it's potentially looking at a very costly employment tribunal if you simply, you know, don't do anything about it or decide, actually, this employee is too much hassle.
I suppose for a transport manager, though, the difference between them raising it and an employee raising it is if the transport manager raises it to the directors or the senior management and nothing is done about it and the process, whatever the process is, continues, that unsafe practice continues, then the transport manager, having been aware of it and the process continuing, finds themselves in a position where they could still end up being prosecuted by the health and safety executive because they're an officer or a manager of the company. So their position is a bit different from in the criminal law to just the standard employee that you're referring to there. So anyone who's a manager or an officer of the company needs to think about it in those terms. Has the actual issue been resolved? Don't just raise it and think, oh, well, I've raised it. They're not listening to me. It's now their problem. That just doesn't apply. So I think also in relation to this scenario that we've got here, the fact that there's no risk assessment. I mean, is that, Scott, in your experience, something that's typical in the transport industry? Not just in relation to cleaning tanks, but just generally, what's your view?
Yes and no. I think we see a real mixture. We see companies that have reams of very good, up-to-date risk assessments that then aren't followed. We see lots of companies that have a very dusty folder sat somewhere in the office that somebody gave to them once upon a time that nobody's ever looked at that has risk assessments in there that aren't followed. And then we have companies that have no risk assessments at all.
We do, of course, have companies that have fabulous systems.
Yeah, fabulous systems and everything else. But we used to do the exercise, so we'd be dealing with health and safety case. Most operators have risk assessments that high vis has to be worn on site, out in the yard. That's a really common risk assessment. I know Mark's probably done it before. We used to just walk into the middle of the yard with no high vis on and see how long it took anybody to actually tail us off or collar us for it. And when you go and sit in front of the director, so I've just wandered around for an hour with nobody challenging me and in your yard, and you're trying to tell me that you're complying with all your systems. So it's about having the actual RAMS in place and then following the RAMS and making sure the RAMS is actually appropriate for the task that you're seeking to set. The one thing I'd also add to Mark's point about the transport manager not only having to raise it, but then make sure it's sort of resolved. Remember, your transport manager duties to the traffic commissioner. I'd say it's probably similarly applies to health and safety issues that if you believe there's a practice or conduct involved in the use of your vehicles that's against the law or unsafe manner, you have to raise it. Have to raise it in writing. If it's still not resolved, you have to resign as a transport manager and tell the traffic commissioner why, basically. So just remember that principle in place.
And
well,
I think we've talked about health and safety quite a lot in relation to these webinars. And it is clear to us that the health and safety executive are focusing on transport businesses. This is an example. But certainly from our workloads as well, we've noticed an increase, a dramatic increase. And that can be not just as something as dramatic and as tragic as the case that's referred to here, but health and safety executive visiting operating centres where there's been no incident, just going and having a look and looking at transport management plans, what risk assessments are in place. So we are, I feel, an industry that's under the spotlight by the HSE at the moment, and it really is time to focus on the health and safety procedures that you've got in place. And what I always say to operators is, we talk a lot on these webinars and other things that Backhouse Journals do in relation to compliance with the operator's license. And generally speaking, the standard's pretty good in terms of compliance with the operator license obligations, your driver walk around checks, your PMIs, driver's hours and so forth. Health and safety, though, seems to be neglected by many operators. And I often say, look at the transport management team that you've got in place versus the health and safety team. And usually the transport management team dwarfs the health and safety team. And I think it's going to get to a stage where those teams need to be of a similar size to make sure you comply with health and safety. Because at the end of the day, a health and safety prosecution, in terms of the outcome of it, is serious in terms of level of fines and imprisonment. So there needs to be a real focus on this stuff. I'll move on just to perhaps some less clothes.
Yeah, two questions really quickly. Okay. Should an external transport manager have insurance? And if yes, what type?
I'd say you need professional liability insurance.
Yeah.
I have taken on a new operator in the recovery sector whose license is granted but will not respond to emails, phone calls or text messages, will not agree to set up a meeting, no license discs have been issued. How long do I give this operator before I resign?
I'd set everything down in writing, ask for an urgent meeting within the next fortnight. If you don't get any response from that, I'd probably resign.
Yeah. You're putting yourself at risk if you're on a license where the operator acted in that way, and you resign, and then the operator will get a letter even from the OTC proposing to revoke the license or the scout.
Yeah, so it'll be resolved one way or the other.
Yeah, because there's no transport manager then. So they propose to revoke the license, and then the operator has to try and grapple with that. Okay, moving on. COVID-19, where are we now? We'd hope that we were done with the thing. But as I said at the beginning, rates do seem to be going up. So Stephanie, from an employment perspective, what is the current position if you've got an employee who perhaps has got COVID? What are you supposed to do? What's the current guidance, if any?
Yeah, well, to be honest, the guidance hasn't changed since I think it was the 1st of April. Your employees are no longer obliged to tell you if they've got COVID. And obviously they're no longer obliged to self-isolate. Well, you know, nobody is. So really it does come down to a matter of what your company's policies are still. You might find that people who have, you know, employees that have got COVID are ringing up and saying, you know, I'm not fit to work, I feel too ill. In which case, you know, it's relatively straightforward. You just kind of deal with it in the same way that you would deal with a normal sickness absence issue. Obviously, you might want to exercise some discretion as to when they come back to work, because, you know, if after a couple of days they're not feel okay to return but they're still testing positive, you know, you're going to have to weigh up the risks of keeping them off and bringing them back in. You know, are they likely to come back in and still be contagious and pass that on to somebody else? So, you know, you might want to think about operating a policy whereby, you know, they're off for, I don't know, 5 days or until they're presenting a negative test. But again, as I said, the government removed all the guidance for employers. I suppose any support for employers as to what they're supposed to do when they've got employees off with COVID. But, you know, if you've got somebody who's got COVID, but they're saying, look, I'm testing positive, but I'm feeling absolutely fine, I want to come to work, then it's a little bit more difficult, because essentially, you know, if you have done a risk assessment and you've decided, actually, you know, this person works in an office with, I don't know, five other people, we can't afford to have this person come in, infect everybody and lose, you know, potentially the whole office, then, you know, I think you're going to have to take a view that you suspend that person, you know, essentially medically suspend that person, but it's probably going to have to be on full pay, which, you know, I know is slightly annoying, but you've got to treat it the same as any other illness. You know, if you were going to suspend anybody for any kind of medical illness and you were keeping them out of the office, then, you know, that choice is on you, and, you know, you are going to be liable for the pay. So realistically, the circumstances are very much the same as they have been, but obviously, you know, we're just noticing it a little bit more at the moment because the number of cases is definitely on the rise.
And I suppose as an employer, yes, you don't want to have to pay and medically suspend somebody on pay. But at the same time, you've got that duty to your other employees, haven't you? Which competes with that. So whilst it might be tempting to just allow them to come in, do bear in mind that you've got that duty to your employees. And if the worst happens, for example, if somebody was to fall seriously ill and even die, and you were aware that they had an underlying health issue, well, the whole health and safety regime starts coming into play again in relation to potentially those high fines and even imprisonment. So don't be tempted to allow people to come in in order to avoid paying them because they're medically suspended. Okay. I think we've just got over to 1 o'clock now, so we'll try and wrap it up there. But just to mention that we've got the following list of training sessions lined up. Bridge strike, so is a popular one, and the one-day operator license awareness course. Scott is delivering that, I think, aren't you, Scott?
There's only a couple of places remaining on those. If you want to book on, I would recommend doing it quickly.
One thing the OLAC does touch on is sort of that engagement between directors and senior managers and transport managers and how that process is meant to be managed. It also goes on about health and safety aspects of the operation as well, I believe. So yeah. It's really quite a good one to get on. The other one I'd say is the TAHU RAF rule enforcement, which has been a massive change. Anybody who's not done it should really look at doing it. It's about the recording of other work.
What I'd say is, in relation to the OLAT as well, is that if you're in an organisation, you might be a transport manager, you might be a director, and if you're thinking the other directors perhaps don't really fully understand what the obligations in relation to operator licensing are, then that is the course to get them on. It's a day-long course, but it's well worth them understanding what the obligations are, because otherwise they can't fulfil their functions properly in knowing how to deal with issues that arise in relation to the operator license. I suppose it's so they know what good looks like, to put it in.
The case law in the Upper Tribunal says that the directors of the collective have to have enough knowledge to adequately manage the operator license. So that's where that kicks in.
Yeah. Okay, right, I think we're done. Yeah. I'll let you cover this bit.
I don't need to. Just finally, before you close, Mark, the next webinar, we will be back on your screens on the 5th of August. So we look forward to seeing you all then.
Well, just to point out, that is missing one of our usual slots, is that we do this every other week, but that's going to be a missing one. So don't try and tune in 2 weeks' time because we're over here. Okay, thank you, everybody.
Yeah, see you next time. Thank you very much.